So we see here in this passage an example of that kind of ironic dislocation that I was talking about. We see, for example, that in the opening passage, the word government becomes a word that has a kind of multivalence, or it means one thing that we're accustomed to it meaning, and Thoreau starts to make it mean something else. He says, government is at best but an expedient, but most governments are usually, and all governments are sometimes, inexpedient. And you'll see that word expedient come up later. Typically it means what's practical or convenient. And so here you see both the word government and expedient meaning something, ironically meaning something different than what the what we think that they might mean or what they're used to meaning. And as the essay progresses, you start to understand that what Thoreau is talking about with government is that when he says that the government that is best that governs least, he doesn't mean libertarianism or small government. He means the government that does not discipline us. That is to say, that does not make us its subjects. And there's... So in fact, Thoreau is quite ahead of a lot of postmodern thought, 20th century thought with regard to the question of subjectivity. I'll give you one example. He says on page 359, "The mass of men serve the state thus, not as men mainly, but as machines with their bodies. They are the standing army and the militia, jailers, constables, posse, comitatus, etc. In most cases, there is no free exercise whatever of the judgment of the moral sense, but they put themselves on a level with wood and earth and stones, and wooden men can perhaps be manufactured that will serve the purpose as well." So we have a kind of what Michel Foucault would call disciplinary cultures, discourses, and what he would call the conditions of the possibility for the constitution of the subject are. That is to say that a lot of Thoreau is sort of grappling in his own language with, in a lot of ways, a failure of the Enlightenment. Which is something that 20th century philosophy and theory would think about and that Foucault would write about. What do I mean by that? Well, if you read, for example, and Thoreau doesn't discuss John Locke directly in here, but if you, I think Lockean philosophy is sort of a shadow text in this or is a part of this conversation. If you read Locke's second treatise of civil government, one of the things that you get is a theory that briefly, and this is something we've talked about in class, that the laws of nature, that nature is governed by a set of laws. And the belief, and those laws can be accessed by reason. And there was a belief in the Enlightenment period that those laws of nature can that nature is lawful just as there are laws of man or human beings and laws of societies, and those laws can be determined by reason. And there's a belief thus in the foundational in reason, human reason, as foundational to the human subject, and that that foundation is sort of trans-historical and stable and consistent. And what is ephemeral is irrationality or unreason or custom or truth by sort of brute force or dogma, right? And so you see in Locke's second treatise of civil government this notion of what he calls a state of nature, which is that society is formed by individuals who, in a state of nature that is absent of society, have freedom, but they consent to give some of their freedom away in order to form a government that protects their rights and particularly their property, right? Now, not only is property an issue here for Thoreau because it's tied to the sort of economics of the fundamental economics of slavery, and Thoreau is a critic of the notion of property, but also what's at issue is this notion of the Enlightenment notion of the rational individual. And Thoreau is looking at this and saying, we have a situation where we have a country, America, that is supposed to be, as he says, the refuge of liberty. And yet it has sanctioned slavery, even in its constitution. How are we supposed to believe that human beings, that individuals, are rational agents forming a just society? That is to say that in the beginning of this essay, in a lot of ways, Thoreau's notion of, he's trying to remind us that governments come from people. That the government is only here to serve our interests. We don't serve the interests of the government. He's trying to remind us of that human interests antedate government interests, right? But part of the reason why he's doing that is because he is idealizing the notion of a virtuous individual rather than a rational autonomous individual. That is to say, if we compare it to Locke might be thinking of the individual as simply free in a state of nature, and Thoreau is imagining, what if the individual were virtuous in a state of nature and they brought that virtuousness to government? Then government would become plastic and it would have to conform to the virtues of the individual. But Thoreau recognizes that this is an idealism. As he says at the bottom of page 357, but to speak practically and as a citizen, unlike those who call themselves no government men, I ask for not at once no government, but at once a better government. Let every man make known what kind of government would command his respect, and that would be one step toward obtaining it. So he's acknowledging that he's not a libertarian, he's not an anarchist. Right. He's trying to affect, essentially, you know, we saw with Jonathan Edwards that he was around in the period of the Great Awakening, which was this rebirth of religious affection. And you could sort of think of Emerson and Thoreau as kind of trying to affect a second Great Awakening, one that's not expressly or explicitly secular, but one that is certainly not particularly not based in organized religion or theology. And this Second Great Awakening is a moral awakening, or an awakening of the moral sentiment. And the passage I was looking for, let's see. Yeah, he said, I'm sorry. So this is the one I meant. At the bottom of 359, he says, yet such as these are even commonly esteemed goods, as most legislators, politicians, lawyers, ministers, and office holders serve the state chiefly with their heads, and as they rarely make any moral distinctions, they are as likely to serve the devil without intending it as God. And that's important, so that he recognizes that even though he's idealizing this notion of the virtuous individual existing prior to the formation of government or bringing to government his or her virtue and then transforming the government based on that virtue, he is recognizing that that's an idealism and that the real problem. And if we put this in conversation with Locke, the real problem is that we aren't individuals prior to society. We're actually in a state of society. We are fundamentally social beings, right? And so part of this essay's concern is, how does that socialization or that sociality make us do things that are immoral because we become accustomed to society's customs, which are immoral. And in this case, that is slavery, right? And Thoreau's solution to that is that we need a second great awakening of the moral sentiment, right? He brings, I'll point you to another passage. He says, interestingly, on 361, when the friction comes to have, okay, so he talks about all government is imperfect, right? But he says that there are conditions for which we should have civil disobedience, by which he means we don't try and change, we don't try and work within a system that is corrupt. We try and transform that system. Actually, I'll point you to page 358. So he says, a government in which the majority rule in all cases cannot be based on justice. This is towards the beginning of 358. Even as far as men understand it. Can there not be a government in which majorities do not virtually decide right and wrong, but conscience? In which majorities decide only those questions to which the rule of expediency is applicable? Must the citizen ever for a moment or in the least degree resign his conscience to the legislator? Why has every man a conscience then? I think that we should be men first and subjects afterward. It is not desirable to cultivate a respect for the law so much as for the right. The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do any time what I think right. And this gets at fundamentally a tension between sort of two tendencies in American thought. One is sort of the notion that conscience, or what is sometimes at this period of time called the higher law, should determine what one's conduct is, or what one does, or what the government should do. This notion of political pragmatism, having nothing to do with the American philosophical movement pragmatism, but with the notion of that there has to be compromise and you have to work within the Constitution, the limits of the Constitution and the limits of the law. And so we might call this a tension between, which these are terms that were thrown around, between the higher law and man's law, or the law of human beings or earthly law. And those who sort of said, you know, it was claimed by some that, you know, I subscribe to a higher law, which is the law of divinity or the law of moral rightness, or for Thoreau, this is social justice. And these two opposing, or these tensions, I think if you look at American society today, continue to play out. At this time, they were sort of embodied and typified in a polarizing way between figures like John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. John Brown represents the manifestation of a commitment to the principles of the higher law, that slavery was a great sin and it had to be corrected, and one had to go above the law and in fact break the law, which Thoreau advocates here. And that's why when John Brown tried to lead an insurrection in Virginia of free slaves and lead a slave insurrection, and that's why when he went to Kansas during the so-called Bleeding Kansas episode and fought white settlers who were tied to slavery and murdered some of them, he was sort of lionized and sort of lauded by Thoreau because Thoreau thought of him as an embodiment of the higher law, which he is advocating here. Under extreme conditions, the higher law should prevail, which entails breaking the law. And you see, too, this is how Thoreau's ideas come to influence Martin Luther King Jr. There's another passage here I'll try and point out before we're done that does that as well. Lincoln would sort of embody the notion of working within the system, right? And Lincoln started much more in the center. He even sort of was an apologist for slavery at certain points, because his priority was unionism, and eventually fought to end slavery with the Civil War, but certainly did it through working within the Constitution, right? And there's a big sort of question at this time of whether the Constitution was sufficient enough to be able to defeat slavery. Let us see. He says on 362, practically speaking, the opponents to reform in Massachusetts are not 100,000 politicians at the South, but 100,000 merchants and farmers here who are more interested in commerce and agriculture than they are in humanity and are not prepared to do justice to the slave and to Mexico, cost what it may. I quarrel not with far-off foes, but with those who near at home cooperate with and do the bidding of those far away and without whom the latter would be harmless. So you see here shades of, or a prefiguration of Martin Luther King Jr. and the letter from Birmingham jail, that the issue is the indifference or the silence of the so-called moderates or the centrists or the kind of middle-of-the-road folks who are against slavery but don't want to become active resistors to that. And Thoreau sort of satirizes them by saying they read the trades in Mexico and fall asleep over the papers, the newspapers at dinner. And then he says, what's the price current of an honest man? How much does an honest man go for on the trade or on the stock market? And that... That's an example of that kind of use of ironic dislocation that Thoreau has. And there's a lot of interesting things to be pointed out here about voting and the limits of voting. But I think I will make one more observation, which is that Thoreau goes to prison, the Concord jail, and for not paying his poll tax, and he's released the next day. There is sort of this apocryphal story that Emerson came to see him in the Concord jail, and the story kind of helps make one of the points of the essay, which is, so Emerson comes to see him in the Concord jail and says, what are you doing in here, Henry? And Henry responds to Emerson by saying, what are you doing out there? And that sort of makes up a big section of the essay where Thoreau talks about, you know, again, his use of irony, that upending the notion of, you know, those who go to prison are usually thought of as, you know, sort of immoral or amoral. And he turns that around, or turns it on its head, and says those who are not in prison are the ones who are amoral. There's an interesting passage when he gets released, and he says, this is on page 380, it was formerly the custom in our village when a poor debtor came out of jail for his acquaintances to salute him, looking through their fingers, which were crossed to represent the grating of a jail window. I'm skipping forward, actually. So he says, when I was let out the next morning, I proceeded to finish my errand, and having put on my mended shoe, joined a huckleberry party who were impatient to put themselves under my conduct, and in half an hour, for the horse was soon tackled, was in the midst of a huckleberry field on one of our highest hills 2 miles off, and then the state was nowhere to be seen. So he has this interesting moment where he, his party affiliation is huckleberries and not any government party, right? And what does this mean? Well, on 383, he says, seen from a lower point of view, the Constitution, with all its faults, is very good. The law and the courts are very respectable. Even this state and this American government are, in many respects, very admirable and rare things to be thankful for, such as a great many have described them. But seen from a point of view a little higher, they are what I have described them. Seen from a higher still and the highest, we shall say what they are, or who shall say what they are, or that they are worth looking at or thinking of at all. So we have this kind of transcendentalist movement in the essay of ascendancy. That is to say that when he's in the jail, he's in the center of the machinery of Concord. He describes it as a medieval town. And he describes the clock, and this goes along with the tropes of machinery. But as he turns away from the machinery or leaves the machinery, he enters nature, and he climbs a hill, and from that hill he gets a different perspective, and that becomes that notion of perspective becomes the notion. It parallels this, or it becomes a metaphor for this notion of transformation of perspective, that one's moral perspective changes. And this is something that he's part of this what I would call the second, this transcendentalist great awakening, this emphasis on the activation of a moral transformation or transfiguration. And when that occurs, we start to see that, yes, you know, as he's saying, America has done some great things, but it is, there are higher laws or higher perspectives, or we can come into a new moral awareness of the need for America to go beyond what it has done, and to become a more just society. So, that will, I think we'll leave it there.